This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Good day, greetings, hello. It is Art at the End of the World, the podcast that features artists, entertainers, and cultural leaders speaking about what it is to make art here at the end. My name is Mark Wigmore. Thank you for being here. Thank you for checking in. And this is a special Oscar Week episode of the podcast, and we have the perfect guest to weigh in on the current climate of cinema. In 2020, filmmaker and legendary producer in this country and throughout Hollywood and around the world on the world cinema stage, Robert Lantos. And we think of the films of Adam Egoyan and David Cronenberg and the Oscar and Golden Globe nominated Barney's Version, all the TV shows he's responsible for, and countless awards. Robert is truly a powerhouse within the industry. So glad to have him here. It was a snowy day in Toronto when we got together a few weeks back, and it was a fascinating conversation about film and award season, but also about a challenging childhood for him and his passion for his latest project, The Song of Names. So lots to get to with Robert in just a moment. And we are at the height of film award season, right? So maybe you're in the mood to take another deep dive with a great film mind. My remix conversation with TIFF co-head Cameron Bailey was released last Thursday. Three different conversations with Cameron, including his recent stop over at the New Classical FM to offer his thoughts on how the most recent edition of the Film Fest went and his ideas on Martin Scorsese and Netflix moving into the movie game. So download it or stream it where you enjoy podcasts. A great conversation with Cameron Bailey and a nice companion to what you're about to hear. I want to point out, too, that in the last week, we are in award season that includes music and television. And on the music side of things, the Juno nominations were announced last week. And for our American listeners, that is the Canadian version of the Grammys. And big congrats to our first guest from this season of the podcast, Alexandra Strelitzky. She picked up three Juno nominations, and this is her first appearance at the Junos altogether. And that list includes Album of the Year, which is incredible. There's people like, you know, Bryan Adams and Alicia Cara in that category. And her little album, Inscape, is part of that conversation, just a feather in her cap. And you can listen to that conversation with Alexandra as well, episode one of this season's Art at the End of the World. I'll remind you, this episode is sponsored by Red Eye Media, a leading arts and entertainment communications company working with award-winning clients, including the Musical Stage Company, Summerworks Performance Festival, and Crow's Theater, of course, many others. RedEyeMedia.ca. To learn more, a wonderful organization for your arts organization. Art at the End of the World is also brought to you by Crow's Theater, one of this country's most acclaimed arts organizations, and based in Toronto's vibrant East End community. They have a couple great titles arriving on their roster very soon. Crow's Theater creates unforgettable theater that examines and illuminates the pivotal narratives of our times. CrowsTheater.com. More info and tickets. And thank you to that great organization. So the Oscars are being held on Sunday, and a man who is no stranger to that whole scene is today's guest. Watch the band, you a bunch of dancers, quickly follow the unknown. Music from Adam Egoyan's film The Sweet Hereafter, nominated for Oscars, the grand prize winner at Cannes way back in the late 90s, and the product of a relationship shared between director Adam Egoyan and his longtime producer Robert Lantos. Robert was born in Hungary and fled with his family during the Hungarian Revolution in the 1950s. and he had to adjust to life in Uruguay before eventually making his way to Canada as a teenager. It was not an easy life. I can imagine that would be difficult for anyone, and we'll hear more about that with Robert in just moments. He eventually found his way into film through distribution, eventually getting into producing, and then co-founding Alliance Communications for Film and Television. No small company. That was a big deal. And to date, he has produced over 40 films, including names like I mentioned, Barney's Version, adapted from Mordecai Richler's book, Oscar nominees like Eastern Promises, directed by David Cronenberg, and Being Julia, starring Annette Bening and Jeremy Irons, and like I say, countless TV programs as well. His recipe when it comes to the movies is to seek out stories he likes, often Canadian, and then find a way to get A-list Hollywood stars into the roster of talent. And it has been a very successful strategy. His latest is no different. The Song of Names. It was released on Christmas Day and directed by the man behind the Oscar-nominated The Red Violin, Francois Girard, and starring Clive Owen and Tim Roth. Here's a moment.
My dearest brother, from the depths of my soul, I must ask you not to find me. You must think of me now as dead.
He is genius. I go back to Warsaw to my wife and daughters. If I can find somebody to teach David, I leave him here.
I have a family in mind, Mr. Rappaport. My own son is David's age, and I can promise you the tenets of your religion will be fully respected.
Tonight will be Rappaport's first ever concert on an international stage. So great has been the impact of this 21-year-old Polish immigrant that one tends to forget how little known his name still is.
Did he say where he was going after the rehearsal?
He didn't. I'll keep an eye out.
Go and find him.
I'm looking for David Rappaport.
Rappaport, R-A-P-R-T. He would have been here in the 1950s.
He was a virtuoso.
When was the last time you saw him?
London. Takes the violin right out of my hands.
You never heard nothing like it in your life.
A moment from The Song of Names, another film where the violin and classical music play an important role, just like the Red Violin. And it's a narrative that sees a family ripped apart by the horrors of the Second World War. Howard Shore, the legendary Toronto composer, is behind the score, and he will be my guest right here on the podcast on Thursday. So let's get into it. Robert Lantos, sort of an interesting story on how this all came together. We knew that Robert wanted to do something on this film. He wanted to get together, talk about it, but he wasn't able to make it into the Classical FM studios. So I suggested that we get together at his Serendipity studio, Serendipity Point Films, which is his production company. So that's what we agreed on. And I pushed to get a full hour with him so that we could talk about his entire career. And I remember parking. It was a cold and snowy day in the city, but the sun was shining and his Midtown Toronto office is very, very nice. And so while I got organized and got set up, his lovely team brought me updates on when he was going to arrive. And he's a very busy guy. So we were sort of in a holding pattern there. And they kept bringing me cappuccinos, which was nice. So I waited. And it was just a thrilling experience. The movie posters all around the office, all around the boardroom. The awards were all on display, gleaming in the sunshine. All this film history in the building. Just really fascinating to look at. Really gave me a sense of his accomplishments over the decades. Just very relaxing. I don't get a lot of time to myself like that. And so that was a nice, very nice experience. But Robert, he was running late. And it got to the point where I didn't know if I could stay because I had to be on the radio at Classical FM. Luckily, he arrived within just minutes of my hard out time. And so we were able to sit down, and he was very nice, very professional, looked great, snappy suit. And we sat down, and we're getting to know each other and shaking hands and discussing a few formalities. And he let me know right then, he was quite adamant about this, that he wanted to focus on the new film, The Song of Names. That's what he wanted the conversation to be about. And I had every intention of doing that and getting to it, but I wanted to be sure that we could get to some other parts of his career as well and his life. And Robert, I'll admit, seemed a little hesitant to do that. So you can imagine, I'm all hopped up on caffeine, and I'm very worried about time. And Robert is letting me know what he wants to do with the conversation, and he's not, you know, he's not mincing words.
So I suggested that we just kind of get into it and see how it feels. And you might notice that it's a little tight off the top. Maybe you won't, but both of us just trying to figure out how it's all going to go. And I think the results, they speak for themselves. And I'll let Robert have the last word on how he felt it went. But very positive, and I think you're in for a big treat with this conversation. We are in a changing media landscape, and film is not left out of that conversation at all. In fact, it's probably in the forefront. And when you're a guy like Robert, you've been around for decades doing this, and he's been producing important, cinematic, dramatic films that are not full of superheroes. And here he is in 2020 still doing it, and he's watching the industry basically get turned upside down. And you bring in all the streaming services like Netflix and Amazon and what they're producing. Really, very fundamental big changes are happening in real time. And he's also been through the award season wheel, that grind before, and he has thoughts on that scene as well. So strap in, a fascinating conversation with one of the biggest names in movies in this country and around the world, Robert Lantos, on Art at the End of the World.
What's your car? What is a guy?
Well, they range from, I have a convertible electric smart car.
So not today.
Today I got a ride from somebody.
Right.
So today I have no car here.
Right. Fair enough.
But then when it's snowing like that, that's not a good idea. So then I drive a Range Rover.
Nice. How are you doing this moment in your career where I would imagine it's not as it used to be, or maybe not quite the same cycle? How do you look at that at this point in your career? Do you say, I'm going to slow down the projects, I'm going to keep going at a pace that I'm comfortable with? What do you think about?
Well, I mean, you know, my career is essentially divided into three chapters. Chapter one was, wow, I can make movies.
Yeah.
And I studied film in school, and I started a little distribution company, not because I knew anything about distribution, but I figured that would be maybe a way into the film business, into making movies, because back then in Canada, there were very few being made at all.
And, right.
To try and find a way in, I came up with this idea of film distribution, and that for the first couple of years, and then I made my first film, which came together through a bunch of magic and trickery, and it's called L'Ange et la Femme, starring Carol Orr, who was a big star back then. I had just been in an Oscar-winning film called Get Out Your Handkerchiefs, and it was directed by the late Gilles Carle, and it was made for no money at all, in 16 millimeters in black and white, but feature film. And then after that came In Praise of Older Women, which amazingly turned into a worldwide hit. Lo and behold, I was making movies, which I, you know, seemed like a fantasy just a couple of years earlier.
I've had a couple minutes before you arrived to wander around your studios and to see these posters and to see the many, many, many awards on your walls. And it does feel like it's sort of an inspiring place to sit. It must be for young filmmakers and so on who come in here and maybe get a chance to speak with you and see all that's happened here.
Well, my advice to wannabe filmmakers is find another career. So not necessarily the most inspiring person to talk to, because the film as it was and when I started is kind of dying, so beaten out by superhero movies about people who fly and put out fires with their eyes and lift high rises with their fingertips, which occupy most of the real estate in movie theaters on the one hand, and the streaming services on the other, which keep grown-ups at home. So between those two, in the kind of film that I like, cinema as opposed to video games on the screen, that is on its deathbed. So those who are serious about cinema, I kind of advise them to do something else. But coming back to your initial question, my first chapter was that, you know, oh wow, I can actually make movies. And that took that sort of took me from my mid-20s until my mid-30s. And then at that point, I got married and I had a couple of children, and I came to the realization that making independent films at that point really meant living at the edge of the precipice and hoping to be able to pay rent and the staff long enough in between projects to survive, which didn't bother me at all in my 20s. It was just the sheer exhilaration of it that was the only thing that mattered. But then, as I got into my mid-30s, I actually had to try and figure out how I could create some stability with which to support a family. And that led to Chapter 2, which was the forming of Alliance, which was the merger of three Canadian companies, two production companies and a distribution company. And together, for the first time in this country, we had the girth and the leverage to actually get a bank line of credit, which was unheard of, and be able to function as a studio as opposed to an occasional producer. We branched out into television, which was now we're talking about the mid 80s, and we ended up having cable networks and movie theaters, and expanded outside of Canada into the U.S. and the U.K., and built a company that eventually I took public on the Toronto Stock Exchange. Those years, which were from my mid-30s until my late 40s, some 14, 15 years, those years were spent mostly building a company and something that on a level at which had never been done in Canada in the entertainment industry, and becoming a global player. And as part of that, I had to walk back from the day-to-day nitty-gritty of producing and the creative process and learn how to run a business and how to run a publicly traded company, and with all of the headaches that comes with that. So we became extremely prolific. Making movies was a very small part of what we were doing. We made sometimes three movies a year.
Sure.
But mostly what we made is sometimes as much as 100 hours of television drama a year. And we became a formidable distribution company, often having the number one market share in Canada ahead of Warner Brothers and Fox and Disney.
So really building the machinery, the backbone of this thing.
A real infrastructure for a business, something that had never been done in the content entertainment world in this country.
And did you prefer that challenge over the day-to-day nitty-gritty of movie making?
No, not at all, but it was essential. It had to be done.
I mean,
it was the only way I could, and my partners could, think of how can we convert our lives from being kind of, you know, an independent producer is a very fancy euphemism, and it stands for beggar. It's independent producer is someone who goes hat in hand, looking for financing wherever he or she might find it, regardless of what cost, in order to make the next film.
Yeah.
And so to convert from that into running a successful, profitable business with predictability and sustainability, that's a big leap.
And you did crave that.
Once I had a family and kids, I felt that I had no choice.
Yeah.
So I had lots of mouths to feed.
Right.
And elderly parents. So I had a lot of people depending on me. Once in a while, I made a movie that came from the heart during that period. For example, Black Robe was...
I mean, they're all great films that we're looking at here. Well, Eastern Promises, Sunshine.
That was made later.
Sweet Hereafter.
Sweet Hereafter was made during that time, as was Black Robe. Those were films from the heart, but they really were a tiny part of the business of Alliance.
Did you have to switch your brain over to find that heart in your day? Find room for that heart, for that love of storytelling?
Absolutely no time in my day for any of that. It was in my nights.
Right.
Reading screenplays and looking at the dailies and rough cuts and the kind of thing that a film that you really care about requires, that would be after 11 p.m. At home. That was the night shift. The day shift was occupied.
How's sleeping with all that? I mean,
it's reduced to it's not 8 hours a night.
No,
and that was the case for many years.
Right,
that was phase two, chapter two. I'd say that is my career is divided into three chapters, until I sold Alliance or my controlling interest in Alliance,
right, right.
Which was in now it's 21 years ago, 1998, and that brings us to chapter three, and which is for the past 20 years. I reverted back to the place where I started, which is making films, not really television, with maybe one exception, but mostly films that mattered to me one way or another, not necessarily in the same way, but films that I truly cared for and that inspired me and that I hope would inspire others, knowing fully well that the kind of films I was making, or cinema, as I like to call it,
sure,
was not going to appeal to the mass market, was not going to be competitive with X-Men's next installment or the next Batman or the next Marvel comic, the next disaster movie. That wasn't the world for which I was gunning. But
Let me ask you about that, because Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola have seen some trouble online for their comments. They got dirty with their comments on Men in Tights, and I've seen different interviews with you over the years where you've mentioned it, but actually this is the most, this is the strongest language I've heard you use about that genre of film. And so it is a thorn in your side, maybe not in a financial capacity, but it bothers you in an artistic capacity.
Well, first of all, I think you're being supremely flattering by referring to these concoctions as film. They're not films. That's pretty much what Scorsese said, and I fully agree. They are something, and by all means, those who want to see them, go see them. But they're not films. They are closer to being video games blown up on the big screen. And they have very little to do with acting, with character development, with plausible storytelling, with relevance to the human condition. Nothing to do with any of the above, which is what cinema is. They have a lot more to do with finding new ways to deliver some kind of vicarious thrill to the average 17-year-old every 90 seconds through special effects and digital effects, explosions, car crashes, and plane crashes, and various derivatives of all of that.
Do you have thoughts on how we got there? On how this happened? Because it now seems to run the movie plexus. I mean, this is what gets people into the buildings.
I don't have the exact statistics because nobody does, but
right.
I would venture to guess that the superhero genre is probably 80 to 90% of worldwide box office. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. I was speaking with Cameron Bailey about his relationship with Netflix, and they're happy to take something like The Irishman and make the little bit of money they can have from a 2-3 week run before it goes to Netflix. And a lot of the types of films that you've made over the years, I can imagine that would be a place where they might end up in the modern day. I mean, it's a very difficult moment. We're seeing a year at Oscar where Netflix might actually take home a Best Picture statue. So what's your gauge on that? Are you optimistic about it at all? Or where do you stand on the streaming world we live in?
I have mixed feelings about, not about the streaming world. I think it's a tremendous convenience and creates a plethora of choices.
Mm-hmm.
I have mixed feelings about great cinema ending up on tiny screens. Most people watch the streamers on their laptops or iPads or on their cell phones. And I find that, it's an unfortunate way to premiere a great work of art. So I have mixed feelings about great films not being designed to movie theaters, not designed for movie theaters and not they're designed for movie theaters. I mean, The Irishman is designed, Roma is designed for a movie.
I'm very glad I saw both those films in the theater.
So am I.
I tell people that.
So am I. Yeah. And then watching them afterwards on a tiny screen, I find it's almost an aberration, because you miss most of what the films are really about. You miss the beauty of them,
right.
The poetry. Yeah. The actual art does not truly translate into a tiny screen, because it wasn't shot for that tiny screen. I regret the fact that, frankly, Netflix in particular is contributing to the demise of the cinema experience, which is in a way they are kind of helping the superhero movies take even more real estate and more ground, as the great films end up not playing in theaters at all. Going to a movie theater in proper conditions and with a quality screen and good sound, which is not always the case, but going to a movie theater in proper conditions is not an experience you can duplicate sitting at home alone, with two people watching a tiny screen in between making phone calls and standing up to get a sandwich and maybe also looking at your computer while you're at it, or watching a basketball game,
right.
And which is not unusual. It's a disrespectful way of watching great art. So it fills me with sadness that the collective experience of seeing a great film on the big screen is being consigned to superhero blown up video games.
Let me ask you about, I got a little window into your life while I was here. Obviously, I took a look around your office. I know you have an event to be at as soon as we're done, and I know you're flying back and forth all the time. For me, if I can empathize with your life for a moment, I might look at it and go, it must be exciting to go to Los Angeles, and it must be exciting to have that lunch with a friend and talk about the movie you're going to make. I'm sure in your 20s, it was all those things, and I'm wondering if there's still a thrill in it for you to play a part in that life and have that life.
The truthful answer to that is not really.
So why do you continue then?
Why does an alcoholic drink?
Right. This is the
it's
thing.
An addiction.
Yeah.
I'm trying to wean myself off. Yeah. So far without much success, but I'm determined to get there.
Right.
Just like the alcoholic is determined to not drink.
So the hot restaurant on the strip or something like that, that's no longer an appeal. To go have that lunch with that person and talk about the movie you're going to make and maybe enjoy some sunshine in the middle of a Canadian winter.
But the sunshine is open.
You'll take that.
I'll take the sunshine. I couldn't care less about the rest. Like, I don't go to the Oscars or Oscar parties unless I have a film in contention. That's the only time
Are those fun? Do you have any fun at those?
If you have a film,
yeah.
If you have a dog in the race,
right?
Yes, because you just might win.
It's also it feels very different, the awards race right now. It feels like there's a lot of pressure, to fulfill certain needs of what's going on culturally as well as what's happening.
Well, there's two things going on in the awards business, and neither of them is particularly pretty from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
One is that awards are more and more being purchased. I mean, Netflix is spending, no one knows exactly, but whether it's $30 or $40 million just on the Oscar campaign of Irishman.
And there was just a story about them flying reporters around and so on.
Oh, no, they'll
so
spend, yeah. So between their various contending films, they'll spend $100 million just trying to buy the Oscar. So there is that. And, people used to criticize Harvey Weinstein in his Miramax days. They used to accuse him of buying the Oscars, because he was spending $5-6 million on an awards campaign, which at that time was unheard of.
Right.
Because prior to Miramax, the major studios who used to dominate the Academy Awards, they would spend a few $100,000 on an Oscar campaign. And then along came Weinstein, and he upped the ante to $5-6 million, and he was accused of buying the Oscars. Well, that's like, now it's like a flea compared to what Netflix is doing. So there is that. I mean, you can purchase the awards if you spend enough money and you have a decent film. You can persuade the voters. You can certainly begin by persuading the media, and then the media in turn do your job and they persuade the voters. That's one thing that's going on. And the other thing that's going on is that, and it's been going on now for a few years, is that the quality of a film is completely eclipsed by its level of political correctness.
Yeah.
So for a film to be in the running for major awards, it has to fit the current flavor of what is considered absolutely politically correct.
So there was a big to-do that there were no women directors in the Golden Globe nominations. Difficult moment, because then you start to ask, okay, well, did enough films get made by women? Was there something truly great made by a woman? You know, and it does start to have that greater conversation. I don't think it can be so narrow to say we just have to put a female director in that category.
Now, I've heard some really absurd suggestions. Actually, one female director who I won't name suggested that there should be a separate category for women directors, which I think is the most insulting thing you could possibly say to women. You have to compete separately. Look, we live in a world, not necessarily the world, but the media world, and certainly the film world, where being politically correct is infinitely more important than being artistically excellent. And so and that applies to gender, subgender, and sub-subgender, and skin color, ethnicity, all of those things, they all eclipse artistic quality. Artistic quality comes not second, but whatever, seventh or eighth. So, am I thrilled about that? Probably from the tone of my voice, you could detect that I don't think that it's a healthy environment.
I wonder,
but then I'll be accused of being a middle-aged white man.
Well, I wasn't. I'm glad you said it.
Oh, yeah. That's the greatest sin of all.
It seems to be.
Like being born a criminal. You
know? Well, in the last 5 years or so.
Or middle-aged white man, especially heterosexual middle-aged white man.
Right.
I mean, you're basically.
It's amazing we're even talking right now.
You've been charged, tried, and sentenced. Not sure what the crime is, but you're a criminal.
One of the elements I find when speaking to creative people, especially if you have the success on the level that you have, whether it's been Wayne Mangesha, who I just spoke to a couple of weeks ago, she left Ethiopia during war times there. Cameron Bailey moved around a lot as a kid and went through different things. And just looking at your history, you moved from Hungary to Uruguay to Canada, and it's fairly serious business as to why you're doing that and your family is doing that. There's a revolution in your home country. Your family uproots. What does that install in a young person, and do you think it contributed to the man you are today and the success you've enjoyed?
Well, the first 8 years of my life were spent in Budapest, where I was born, and I felt very much at home. And I knew everybody and the language, and I was completely comfortable. And then when we emigrated and we ended up in Montevideo in Uruguay, I knew no one and I couldn't speak the language. And turned out I was the only Jew in my school, which I don't know how that came to light, but it did. And so I became very much an outcast and an outsider. And I stayed that way pretty much ever since. I learned some in that immigration, and then we came to Canada some 6 years later. And through all, and again, I knew no one. I couldn't speak English or French, and we lived in a Francophone world.
My Lord.
I remember going to my first school dance at Northmount High in Montreal, and all the boys were wearing their bobby socks, and many of them driving their parents' car and dancing, and jitterbugging with the pretty girls. And I and a few other recent new immigrants who, never mind jitterbugging, we didn't even speak English.
Right.
Or French.
didn't have the dance step or the words.
Kind of stood by the wall and watched, and also didn't have car access to my parents' car because they didn't have a car. So it was very much being the outsider, which I for a long time I thought this was a tremendous liability, And I felt that, you know, I felt kind of a sense of, it made me feel insecure and,
sure,
and inferior and not good enough. And then, see, at one point I realized, you see, that actually being the outsider is an asset. And it's an asset because it allows me to see things from a perspective that is not enslaved by the collective fat of the day. And by that, I learned three extremely important skills during these kind of tumultuous emigrations and immigrations and massive changes in my life and my environment, and watching my parents struggle to try and make enough money so that they could pay the rent and feed us, which they did with great difficulty. I learned three incredibly irreplaceable skills that have served me my whole life. The first one was I learned when to fight. I also learned when
That's a very tough skill for people to learn.
I learned to fight, and I had to learn to fight because I often was in fights, especially in Uruguay, because I was.
We're talking physical fights, or just when to turn on the gas?
No, physical fights.
Yeah. Okay.
My very first day in school in Montevideo, I found myself in a fight with six guys, but I didn't know why. But during the first recess, during the first day in school, it was a hot day, and my mother dressed me, so I ended up going to school the way a boy in an eight-year-old would go to school in Hungary on a hot day, in short pants, and I had long hair, so she put a bobby pin in my hair to keep it from falling into my eyes, and I was the only one in the school who was wearing short pants and had bobby pins in his hair.
So there you were,
and I couldn't speak a word of the language, and so. So at recess, as I was standing in the hallway, a boy came up to me and took my hand and kind of did a gesture which I can't replicate on the radio, but it was like one hand cutting the other. And he said the words, corta para la salida, which means essentially, it means that we're making a date for after school, but it was a date to fight.
Right.
I didn't know that.
Right.
So when the second and the third one came over to do the same thing, I actually thought they were being friendly. It must be their version of a handshake.
It's heartbreaking.
But after school, as I was walking to where I was told I had to take the bus to get to my uncle and aunt's place, which is where I was living for the first year, because my parents only had a one-room apartment which didn't have a bathroom. So I didn't live with them for a year in Montevideo. I lived with relatives. So I knew how to take the bus to get there, but I was walking to the bus stop. These six guys who I had agreed to fight with after school followed me.
Right.
And they ride to the bus stop where, since I didn't see any reason to have a fight, nevertheless, they did. So I got all beaten up that day, and that's when, you know, that skill began to develop. But
what are you, 8, 9 years old at that point?
I was 8. There were three essential skills. Learning to fight was one of them, physical fight.
Right.
The second one was also learning when to run. Run, equally important, because when there are six guys behind you, it's best to run. I didn't know that the first time, but
right.
I knew that soon after.
Right.
There were times when running was the best solution, and you have to learn how to run fast so they can catch you. And then the third thing was to know when to run and when to fight, which skill to use when. Those three things served me for the rest of my life.
You are listening to Art at the End of the World. My name is Mark Wigmore. My conversation with Robert Lantos continues in a moment. You're listening to the Zoomer Podcast Network. Mark Wigmore with you on Art at the End of the World. Let's get back to my talk with the legendary filmmaking force in this country and around the world, Robert Lantos.
It's interesting to me, you mentioned the NFB. You've worked with the NFB, you've worked with the CBC, TIFF, big organizations where people climb this ladder.
Well, I never worked with the NFB.
Okay, right. But you applied.
I had a job interview.
You applied for the job. And you went to school and so on. You didn't do the ladder thing. You did not, you know, go through the rungs, as far as I can tell from what I've learned of your history. You looked at that. They told you, hey, you're going to need to be doing, you know, being a part of this organization for a long time before we ever give you the opportunity to do the types of things that you want to do. So it's interesting to me that you have been affiliated with some of these big organizations, and yet you very much bucked the system in your own way.
Well, I never worked for them.
Right. But you were part of the, you were on the board with the CBC.
I was on the CBC board.
Right. I mean, there's no greater ladder structure. I worked for the CBC for 6 years. I mean, I know how that is. Certainly, you know, TIFF is a big organization too. And yet you very much carved your own pathway and did things your own way.
Look, I realized I had to do that at that interview with the National Film Board of Canada.
Right.
I'll tell you, I'll digress for a second and give you the backstory on the interview. So I was in graduate school at McGill, studying what was called communications, which is part of the English department, film and communications. One of the courses, by far the most interesting course, was a graduate seminar in film. There were only seven of us in that seminar, and the professor was John Grierson. John Grierson coined the word documentary. He founded the National Film Board of Canada. But this was late in his life, and he gave this course from his hotel room, a hotel on Crescent Street in Montreal. They didn't like going on the campus. And he would sometimes get us drunk while telling us stories.
Good teacher-student relationship.
Absolutely perfect, yeah. Okay. Well, he'd probably end up in jail if he did that today.
Sure. So at the end of the year,
he turned to the seven of us and he asked each of us, well, you know, what we plan to do now that we are finishing our master's degree. And everybody had different plans and ambitions. And when he came to me, I said, I'd like to do is ask you, I would like you to set up an interview for me at the National Film Board. And he said, and what are you going to tell them? And I said, I'm going to tell them that I want to write, direct, and produce. And he says, and why would they hire you to do that? I said, well, I'm going to show them my student films and my thesis, and you're going to write me a spectacular letter of reference, aren't you? He said, I'll do that. And I'll set up the interview, but I'll only give you one word of advice. If you actually want to get a job there, apply for a job as a driver, fill out the form, go to the receptionist, ask for a form, because they have a very high turnover. Sooner or later, you'll get a call. I said, first of all, I hate driving. I'm not good at it, and I have no interest in doing that. I would like to set up a meeting for me, a proper interview. He said, okay, and he did, and I met with the then commissioner of the film commissioner, the head of the National Film Board, who, because it was John Grierson who had set up the meeting, he fed me high tea and cookies in his office. And then he said, and he listened to me while I told him what I wanted to do and about my various student projects. And he very patiently and politely sat and let me talk for half an hour. And then when I finished talking, he said, come with me and follow me. And he took me along the hallways in Montreal, National Film Board, these kind of very gray, hospital-looking hallway.
Right.
And he would knock on doors and open doors. And behind each door, there was usually somebody sitting in behind his desk. And he would say, this is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so, and this is an Oscar winner for an animated short, and this is so-and-so. And he gave me this whole tour. And then when he finished, he took me back to his office. He sat me down and says, all the people you've just met, see, they're all waiting for their turn for their next film. What the hell do you think gives you the slightest the right to walk in here and say you want to write, direct, and produce just because you know John Grierson? That was the end of that interview.
So I love that story.
That's when I decided, okay, it's not going to happen for me through job interviews and filling out forms.
Right. And so I'm very curious, what was the thinking there? What was the next step where you thought, okay, I am going to have to figure out my own pathway and somehow do this on my own without this typical process in play? What were the first moves?
I was still in school when the first move happened. It was pretty much around this time. I saw an ad in the Village Voice. It was advertising something called the first ever New York Erotic Film Festival, with a jury headed by Andy Warhol, and others on the jury were Gore Vidal and Milos Forman. And
it's like the best cocktail party in town right there.
Sylvia Miles and the feminist painter Betty Dodson. Those are the ones I remember. And it was an ad to ask of independent filmmakers, and at the time they were called experimental and underground filmmakers, to submit their films. And I thought, and there's going to be and I followed up and discovered there was going to be a big opening night event in New York at the Continental Baths. And I somehow, I'm not sure how, conned the defunct, now defunct Montreal Star and CBC Radio, which with a late night show on CBC Radio, to chip in and send me to New York to cover the opening night party of the New York Erotic Film Festival, which took place in the swimming pool of this bathhouse, with the films being projected on the ceiling, and most of the people present in the pool and various other stages of undress, and including Andy Warhol, but he was fully dressed,
right,
with a boa constrictor around his neck.
Wow,
a live boa constrictor. So it was kind of a zoo that maybe couldn't be duplicated or even imagined today. When I was there, I had this idea that if somehow I could bring this to Canada, everybody I know is going to want to be part of it. And I had no idea how to go about doing that, but that was sort of, I eventually did. And that was the first thing I ever did. And to help, but I didn't have the money to pay for the rights to bring this New York Erotic Film Festival to Canada. But I signed an agreement while I was there that I was going to, and they gave me some 30 days to pay. And during those 30 days, I kind of ran around to try and raise $12,000. And the last missing part actually came from your CEO, Moses Neimer, which was actually my first ever business deal, because the late Stephen Roth, who was my friend and became my partner, said to me, you know, I have a friend in Toronto who's starting a TV station, and he's doing some crazy stuff, and why don't, maybe he'll want to put this on the air. So I took the train to Toronto from Montreal, and I went to see Moses on the old...
As so many have.
And he said, well, let's see this. And
yeah.
He had a projector, 16mm projector, in his somewhere in his office. And the projectionist was the late Brian Lenihan. Watched these shorts, some of them 2 minutes long, about two sneakers who end up having sex and making a third sneaker, and some of them 20 minutes long. And after about an hour of this, he said, okay, how much money do you want? And so I said, I need $6,000 for the rights to run this on television. Boy, I didn't care what rights, I just need $6,000. And he said, okay. And I said, this is one thing I needed like today, because I hadn't paid for the rights.
Right. You're really hustling. Yeah.
So he sent someone to a bank, and they came back with a check.
I love it.
And that was sort of, if you ask me the beginning, well, that was the humble beginning.
So if we are watching an Adam McGoyan film or a Cronenberg film, we can think to ourselves, it all started with this strange erotic film festival that came to Canada, thanks to you.
A bunch of shorts, which actually were first shown at McGill University, because I couldn't get a movie theater. I tried, but I didn't know how to go about that. I walked down St. Catherine Street in Montreal and went into the old movie palaces, which no longer exist, and asked for the manager and said, I'd like to play this can of 16mm film under my arm. And I said, I'd like to play this here. And they would say, get the hell out of here.
Isn't youth wonderful, that you wander around and you just, logic dictates that, yeah, I'll just wander into the cinema.
Into the movie theater.
That's how you do it, right?
It didn't work out that way. But it didn't work well. But McGill, where I was the vice president to the student council, and my best friend was the president, and we had a lot of sway about what went on at McGill there. Yeah. See, I knew I worked. So that's where it first played, and sold out, and people were scalping tickets. And that's when I knew, okay, this is going to work. We were selling tickets for $2 a piece. We had three showings back to back, and we sold out the third show before the first show began. And then by the time the third show was on, people were scalping tickets for $10, five times what we sold them for. That's why I knew that this is, we got something.
We got something here. Yeah. You've mentioned The Apprenticeship.
And by the way, I think Moses got busted later on for playing the New York Erotic Film Festival. He put it on City TV in Toronto and on a Friday at midnight. He got busted by the Vice Squad. In Toronto used to have a Vice Squad, a Morality Squad, it was called.
Right.
And they busted them and ended up, and of course, in headlines in across the country. TV station gets busted for obscenity, and then a trial where the judge dismissed the case and said, "You're wasting the court's time," to the police. But that kind of helped make the tiny little city TV became a lot better known after that.
I bet, yeah. And of course, wasn't he sort of known for putting on these like blue lights?
Well, that's what it was. Baby blue.
The baby blue.
Yeah. Friday. That's where this was.
Right. I'm looking at Barney's version, the poster here, and I'm thinking back to The Apprenticeship of Dodie Kravitz, because I know that was a bit of a template for you as far as what you thought was possible within the Canadian landscape of filmmaking. And it seems like you followed that model a lot, where you got great Canadian talent, producers, directors, and so on, and somehow would bring in, you know, a Hollywood star or two and kind of have them be the face of it. And that's how it seems like a lot of these films came to life.
Well, what you just said is very accurate and perceptive, because The Apprenticeship of Dodie Kravitz, which I saw when I was still at university, it was kind of around the time I was finishing, and the film was playing at the Place Ville-Marie Theatre in Montreal, and I thought, wow, this is a Canadian film. This can be done here. Can be done. That was the first time I saw a Canadian film that, to me, felt an English Canadian, French Canadians, that I've seen lots of, but an English Canadian film that actually was as good or better than anything Hollywood had to offer. That was an inspiration, and you know, the deliciousness of fate is that many years later, the producer of The Apprenticeship of Dodie Kravitz, the late John Kemeny, became my partner. And when we founded Alliance with the coming together of three companies, one of those companies was called ICC, and the owners of it were John Kemeny and Denis Héroux. You know, Kemeny had been kind of my model, my inspiration when I was still in film school. So that was a nice twist of fate.
It is a wonderful story, and then everything that happens after that. Tell me about, I mean, David, I think, was just sort of part of the Toronto scene, part of the Canadian scene. When Adam came into your radar and you were starting to see what he was capable of, what was it about him? Because I feel like every film of his, there's a hill to climb, but there's just this wonderful artistic payoff. Almost every film you see that he directs, and you two have worked together a lot.
We also drank a copious amount of wine together last night. Very good wine.
So here we are. Well, good. Geddy Lee would have loved to get in on that. Yeah.
It was Adam, David, Don McKelly, Francois Girard, a couple of others, and I. And
that sounds like a hell of a party.
It was a very seriously committed consumption.
Restaurant or house?
How does at my house.
See, smart.
Supplied by my cellar.
but you obviously saw in him a very specific.
I first heard of him because I had to read out his name, never having seen his film. He was nominated for what was then called the Genie Award for family viewing. And
now the Canadian Screen.
Canadian Screen Awards.
Right.
And I was the chairman of the Academy. And the year was 1985. And the nominations were announced at the Sutton Place Hotel in the ballroom. And as chairman, it fell upon me to announce the nominees, among others, for Best Director. So there was this name I couldn't pronounce, which
it's like my whole life in classical music. Trust me, that's all I deal with. Yeah.
Well, for a name I couldn't pronounce for a film I'd never mind seen but heard of. I think it was Family Viewing. So I pronounced his name wrong, and that's where we met.
Right.
Yeah.
And that started it all. And just a very specific way of telling a story and. I'm in great admiration of what the two of you have been able to do over the last 20, 25 years. So thank you for that, because they have been wonderful. Yeah. All right. I will, if it should.
I'm the enabler.
Get the chance. When do you have to step in to put a stop to something, to change an element of a film? Is that something that you find yourself doing?
I prefer to make the film before making the film. I prefer to talk through all of the various major decisions that go into the making of a film, from the nuances of the screenplay and the casting, the choice of department heads and major locations, and all of those, and then later on comes the editing, which is the third time you make a film. For me, the first time you make a film is when, with the director, you collaborate, and it takes time. It often takes a year or several years as you kind of meditate on the film together. What film is it that we're going to make? During the actual filming process, if I have to step in, that's not good news. It has happened, but that means there's a problem.
Yeah.
Because at that point, they're in a, unlike television, which, and where the director is really a traffic cop, in film, in cinema, that it's the director's vision that counts when you're making the film. So I hopefully don't have to step in. I give, you know, I observe and I share my point of view and opinions and with the director, but that's it. And there are exceptions, and those are usually the problematic ones. Right. And then the third time you make a film is in the editing room. And there I like to be very much present.
You like to be around for that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, I mean, you would know better than I do, but do you find many producers who get involved in that part of the process? Is that pretty typical, or do you feel like you like to be part of that vision and that rhythm?
I can only answer for myself, because there's no, you know, the title producer.
I know, I do need to be careful.
Once upon a time,
that, yeah,
meant something. We sure all knew what it meant. Even when I first started making films, unbelievable, but 45 years ago.
Sure.
I actually knew what it meant, but in the interval, it is it's a word that really could mean anything. It could mean that you're the manager of the movie's star, and so in order to get the star, they kind of bribed you with a producer credit. It could mean that you inherited a lot of money from a wealthy father, and so you can write big checks, so you can become a producer that way. It could mean that you are a person who works on, so something called the line producer, which means that you have no involvement in the creative side of things or the financial side, but you are very much hands-on, the nitty-gritty of running a budget and running a crew. It could mean that. Or it could mean what it once upon a time it meant, which is that you are a filmmaker who looks at the process of making the film from the vantage point of its ultimate destination, which is the audience. Mm-hmm. And so you participate organically in the process from the beginning of the writing of the screenplay until the film is in theaters. But you participate in the process creatively, but you shift perspective. So your perspective is that of how this is going to be viewed by those who it's being made for. That's actually what a producer was,
and that's what,
and
obviously,
since I'm old school, I still am.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you see yourself in that role, and that's what you've done, is be that person who takes it from idea to final product and really be there in that relationship.
But from a somewhat shifted perspective.
Yeah.
Which is, it's not the director's perspective. The director is focused on his or her vision. My mission is to focus on how it's going, that the result of that is going to be perceived by those it's being made for. If it doesn't reach its audience, then it's futile.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a writer, the writing in itself, or a sculptor or a painter, the mission in itself is its own destination. whether it reaches millions of people or the only ones who actually see it or read it are your closest friends. That's just a measure of success, but you can still be making great art, which is why so much great art sometimes is only celebrated after the artist has died.
Yes, I that's also part of my classical job. So many men have just ended up paupers, and then we celebrate them 100 years later.
We know who they are, some of them.
Right.
But film is not like that.
Right.
Film, if it doesn't find its... If no one sees it, then it is a futile exercise.
I want to get into Song of Names. And why this story? What spoke to you to say, I want people to see the Song of Names?
Well, first I read the novel by Norman Lebrecht, who I'm sure you know of. He's one of the world's most distinguished classical music scholars.
Yeah.
In some circles, his name is received with fear and trembling.
Right.
I was taken by the story of this book, but a good story, certainly at my stage of life and career, is not enough of a reason to make a film. There are a lot of good stories. This particular good story had something else within it that I found irresistibly compelling, and that was that in this story about friendship and betrayal and reconciliation set in the world of classical music, there was a way that Norman Lebrecht provided the reader with of remembering the genocidal horror of the Holocaust and without actually visiting the events themselves. And he did that by creating this, what we call the Song of Names. And so that through a piece of music, which reveals the actual mystery of this story, it is where through this piece of music that the revelations come as to what happened to one of our two protagonists, mm-hmm. who disappears on the eve of his first solo concert. What happened to him and why? I found that so intriguing because I thought it would give me an opportunity to remember and to give others a way of remembering something that must never be forgotten, because the only way we can avoid the tragedies of the past is by never forgetting them. It was memory, it was remembering, but a way of remembering that had not been done before in any film I'd ever seen, that intrigued me. But that was further compounded by the environment in which we live today. And perhaps I would have been less compelled 25 years ago.
But yeah.
Today we, I am the son of two Holocaust survivors. I grew up with the story of the Holocaust pretty much from my mother's milk.
Your parents were comfortable talking about it. I mean, some parents weren't comfortable talking about it.
Mine were.
Yeah.
My other members of my family were not, but my parents were. And not at first, because I didn't even know I was Jewish until I was 8 years old. But,
right.
So that was not, it was not talked about then. But later on, yes. It was assumed by those who lived through all that and those who are the descendants of survivors that what led to the mass murder of 6 million Jews was something of the past, that it could never happen again, and that lesson had been learned forever and ingrained forever in the collective memory of humankind. That turned out to be false optimism. And as Jew hatred has been sweeping across Europe now for the past couple of decades and gathering more momentum each day, and it has leapfrogged across the Atlantic and is certainly, and it's a cancer that's spreading on most campuses across North America under various different sort of labels like the BDS movement or anti-Zionism, all of which are thinly disguised versions of the same thing. Plus ça change, plus ça reste le même. So, and that's the environment in which we live today. And because of that, that. And specifically because of that, I feel motivated to do whatever I can, which is not very much, but I do have some resources and some skills, so I'm not limited to making donations to Jewish organizations. I can be more useful by making a film that hopefully will reach a significant number of people, and through a well-told tale and emotionally compelling tale, remind people of where the road of hatred leads.
You then must believe that this art form can be an agent of change. That even with the watered down cinematic world that we live in now, that this story being out in the world does something and means something and can change hearts and minds.
Yes, I do believe that. I think that, I am not wildly optimistic about reaching a mass market in the superhero world with a film about friendship and betrayal and reconciliation and classical music.
But you are compelled.
I do believe that between movie theaters and eventually the streaming and iTunes and various digital platforms, the film will be seen by millions, one way or another. Mm-hmm. It packs an emotional punch.
It does.
And the theme of it is universal. I think that it will have an impact on those who see it.
The idea of remembrance through music, through song, is just a wonderful notion in this film, and I couldn't agree with you more. That I think, we don't want to give too much away about what people are going to experience, but that is a great part of this film. So we've got violin music, jumping through time and location, great cast, Francois Girard, an outstanding score. I think you can see where I'm going here. If we like the Oscar award-winning film, The Red Violin, this is, I would say, something of a companion piece. I mean, it deals with classical music and so on and so forth, but very much its own story and lives in its own world, even though there may be some comparisons, even great stars. You must have looked at that former film and thought, okay, we've got a lot of the same ingredients here that are...
Well, look, there are two people who, well, really three people, who were the essential architects of this film. After I read the book, I then discovered there had been a screenplay adaptation of it written by Jeffrey Kane, who's an Oscar-nominated screenwriter. And I then got a hold of the rights to the screenplay, and first the book, then the script. And then I sent it to Francois Girard. The reason why was because I'd never worked with Francois. I knew him, but yes, he directed The Red Violin and also 32 short films about Glenn Gould, and he's also the Yo-Yo Ai film on Yo-Yo Ma. And
he had his classical chops.
And he is as comfortable in the world of the opera and as he is in the world of film. He was the one person I actually knew, one filmmaker I knew, who is equally at home in the language of classical music as he is in the language of cinema. So this was simply the first person that came to mind as I was reading this. So I called Francois, I sent it to him to read, and he was as enthusiastic as I was. The third, absolutely crucial to this enterprise, was Howard Shore. This central component of this film, this piece of music called The Song of Names, that didn't actually exist. It was a line in the book and a line in the script. It says, and then he performs The Song of Names. But there was no such thing as The Song of Names. Mm-hmm. It's not, it had to be invented and created. So Howard began working on the score for this film almost 2 years before we actually made the film, which is the exact reverse of how it usually works.
Right.
The composer tends to be the last one in after the film is edited, but not this time. And so the fundamental pieces of music for this film were written and orchestrated and recorded before the film was made. It's really a testament to the true brilliance and greatness of Howard Shore that he created the wings upon which this story flies. And literally, they are He gave the story its wings, more so than certainly any sound, any music score of any film I've worked on.
He's going to be a guest on the program, so we're so thrilled to have him. And one of the elements that I really love is him. You've got these violin solos that are happening throughout the film, and then he actually works the score to sort of underscore, you know, these violin recitals and so on. It's quite beautiful, and I think quite an accomplishment musically.
François Gérard also had a lot to do with this, because they worked together very closely and collaborated. And occasionally they would give me a peek of what they were doing. And sometimes I'd get impatient and say, okay, it's time for me to hear it before we started making the film.
Right.
And then they would say, well, we're still working on it, wait a little while. And then one day, I heard the first version. Eventually it was refined, but the first version of the central piece of music of the Song of Names. And I cried, which is not something I do often.
No.
At least, not if I can help it. But when I heard it, I had tears in my eyes. And that's, I knew, okay, this is going to work.
They could still be alive. If he wanted to be found, don't you think he would have come to you long ago?
Your family perished?
I don't know.
Why are you wasting your time finding David after half a lifetime?
I might be all he's got.
And Clive Owen, Tim Roth, I mean, both great actors, and I don't think we've seen them quite like this in a film before. Somewhat understated. We're not seeing Tim Roth, you know, dealing with a bullet in his gut or something like that. Clive Owen, these are stretches for these guys, and they allowed them to kind of...
Very much so. I mean, we went to Clive first for the role of Dovidal, even though Dovidal is not in the entire film. Tim Roth's role is much better. Larger. I mean, it takes more screen time. But we went to Clive first, and he asked us, why are you coming to me with this role instead of, why aren't you casting the other role first? And so Francois and I said, well, because this is a story of looking for Dovidal, the violin prodigy who disappears on the eve of his first concert. And so, well, I won't give away more of the story, but... And we said to Clive, you are the one we're looking for. It's got to be worth our while. And he, you know, he took on this role. He had never played anything, any character, you know, remotely like this. It's certainly a stretch in terms of who he is in real life, which is what acting is. He's a great actor. So that's why he took it on. Because he'd never done anything like this. In the case of Tim Roth, who we went to next for the role of Martin, Tim Roth usually plays, as you just said, he's got either a bullet in him or he's putting a bullet in someone else.
That's right, he can be a real tough guy.
Absolutely, or sure. he's trying to rob Sam Jackson at a diner in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
But he usually plays very edgy characters. And I have to give credit Francois with this more than myself. Francois was convinced that we needed to cast an actor who has the edge that Tim Roth has, the absolute sort of built-in, a time bomb that could explode at any time, that because Martin was actually a passive character in our story, he is subordinate to the alpha male Dovidal, that we wanted an actor who had that edge, and to make that the passive observer into someone who was truly interesting. And then... when he does explode, and that's all I'll say about that, however brief it might be, it's memorably powerful.
Sure is. I was frightened in that moment, to be sure. It is a great achievement. I think you put a wonderful group together to make it. And Robert, congratulations on this film.
Thank you very much.
It's really great to spend some time with you today, and thanks again.
You're really good at what you do. It was a pleasure being here.
Right? I think I managed a win on that one. Robert, he's a no-nonsense guy, but we came out friends, and you can see the photos of the two of us right after that conversation is over. And every time I see those pictures, it just makes me laugh. Robert Lantos, good times. Don't forget, you can enjoy The Song of Names with Clive Owen and Tim Roth in select theaters. Keep an eye out for it on streaming services in the weeks to come and for purchase and download as well. And the soundtrack, just fantastic. Howard Shore, the composer. Enjoy listening to it where you download or stream or purchase music. And Howard will be here on Thursday for our remix episode. And it's sort of a new episode in a way because it's two conversations I've had with Howard over the years that I've never put out on the podcast. And we talk about all his work with Martin Scorsese and David Cronenberg and the new film Song of Names. And of course, his Lord of the Rings soundtrack. So Howard is our guest on Thursday. That is it. You can listen to episodes of Art at the End of the World at classicalfm.ca, artattheendoftheworld.com, and everywhere you enjoy listening to podcasts. Subscribe at iTunes and Stitcher and Spotify and SoundCloud. And thank you once again to our sponsors today, Red Eye Media and Crow's Theater. Couldn't do it without you. And thanks to you. Thank you for checking out the program. We're on Facebook. Twitter is at Art at the End. My Instagram handle is at Wigdad. We're back here on Thursday with Howard Shore. We'll speak to you then and for as long as we can.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.